The Holy Gospel according to Mark, the 7th chapter.
Glory to you, O Lord.
Now when the Pharisees and some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus, they noticed that some of his disciples were eating with defiled hands, that is, without washing them. For the Pharisees and all the Jewish people do not eat unless they thoroughly wash their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders. And they do not eat anything from the market unless they wash it. And there are also many other traditions that they observe, the washing of cups, pots, and bronze kettles. So the Pharisees and the scribes asked Jesus, "Why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?" Jesus said to them, "Isaiah prophesied rightly about you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines.' You abandon the commandment of God and hold to human tradition." Then Jesus called the crowd again and said to them, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile. For it is from within, from the human heart, that evil intentions come: fornication, theft, murder, adultery, avarice, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, evil, slander, pride, folly. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person." The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
I invite you to be seated. The last three of the four pieces of scripture that we just heard and proclaimed in our midst focus a lot on getting right with God. I instead want to focus on the first reading, and I'll put it in conversation in a little bit with the other ones in a moment. And I'm going to reread it, even though Alice did a fabulous job the first time, but there was a lot of coming and going. And this is the only time in the lectionary that something from the Song of Solomon, better named the Song of Songs, shows up. And it's actually an alternate reading. So I put it in place of a Deuteronomy reading, partly because the Song of Psalms is kind of embarrassingly erotic. "The voice of my beloved, look, he comes, leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing in at the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, 'Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. For now the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth. The time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away.'" What, you might ask, is this doing in the Bible? You would not be alone in asking this. There was great debate as the canon was coming together about whether this really belonged. In the Jewish tradition, the Jewish scriptures also kind of coming into final formation around the same time that the Christian scriptures are coming into formation. The rabbis debated this too. Some rabbis thought this was basically on the level of a bar song, not worthy of holy consideration. But one rabbi argued that it is the most precious of all scriptures. In the Christian tradition, too, as I mentioned, it only shows up this one time in the lectionary, and it's like plan B. So the preacher has to actually be like, "No, I want to preach on this," which is what I did this week. It is very quickly in the Christian tradition, it became interpreted, and rightly so, on the level of an allegory for the relationship between God and God's people, God and God's creation, this desire this delight, this longing for the presence of the other, of the beloved. Other thinkers, particularly Bernard of Clairvaux, who was writing in the 12th century, he wrote 80-something sermons on just the first two chapters of the Song of Songs, Song of Songs. And he does this beautiful rendering of it in this kind of high medieval, mystical tradition that Luther's actually going to hate. That's a whole other conversation we can have another day. About this wonderful text as showing Christ's beloved desire for the church and the church's love for Christ. And, not but, in its origins, these are in fact poems that celebrate human love, human desire, human sexuality. They are squirm-inducing in a public setting, which is probably, I'm not going to make you squirm, I promise. In how much they celebrate public displays of affection and the kind of raw passion of desire that is created in us and incarnate in us and therefore connects with our God and our God's way of viewing us. It's not a common way for us to think about God, particularly in the Lutheran tradition. Many of the other texts give us other ways that we understand God and perceive God and perceive God to relate to us, very often in terms of judgment, in terms of taking a look and assessing and the love of God making us realize how far short we fall of living up to that love. And that is all right and good. This is not a one way of understanding God knocks the other way of understanding God out. It's all part of the mix. But I want us to dwell for a moment on what it would be like as individual bodies, as a collective body, as this church on in Harvard Square, as all the collective bodies that you all in this room relate to and participate in, if we spent more time imagining, praying, dwelling in the idea that this is the way that God sees us, that God longs for us, delights in us, takes pleasure in us. God's face lights up when we come into the room, the way my face lit up when I saw baby Theo when I came in. And then I said the stupid things to him that adults say to babies. God's delight in us. It might be a more comfortable way to approach that imagination in terms of our longing for God, our desire for God, our desire to be in the presence of God. And again, the scriptures are full of wonderful psalms, sometimes heartbreaking, heartbroken psalms of waiting for God to come near, of longing for that presence of the one in whom you know all will be well and all is well. In the midst of all of the brokenness of the world. But think also of it as God's longing for you, God's desire and delight in you, and what this means for how you view yourself, and how you view each other, and how you view bodies. This celebration of erotic love is not pornography. It is not grounded in power and submission and manipulation. And perhaps that's why it's hard to approach, because it's this delighting love of God that we don't control. And we can't manipulate it. And we can't distort it. Which isn't to say we don't distort and manipulate and seek to control our own sexuality, other people's sexuality. I was in divinity school in the early 2000s at a Jesuit Catholic school of theology, and this is not to pick on the Catholic Church, because it's in all of us. When the clergy sex abuse crisis in the Catholic Church and the Archdiocese of Boston blew up, it wasn't that it was new information, or it wasn't something that just happened, it was that it came to the surface and was exposed. And in the very painful but honest, wrenching conversations that took place among especially my Catholic classmates and especially my Catholic classmates who were preparing for the priesthood, there could be a strain of understanding abuse, assault, sexual abuse and assault as existing on a spectrum of desire. That on the one end you have softer, more gentle, more... I can't think of the other word, sort of approaches to sexuality. And on the other end is something sort of aggressive. And our fabulous professor of pastoral care and counseling spoke almost shoutingly in one of these public conversations among the community to say, no, abuse exists on a spectrum of violence. Abuse exists on a spectrum of power and control. It is not about desire. It is about power and manipulation. How different this imagination from the Song of Psalms. Some commentators even hear in the Song of Psalms, which is full of garden imagery, the lushness of creation. We heard in this how the winter is ended. And after last winter, if we can remember back after this glorious summer, you can appreciate the sense of relief at the return of the turtle dove song and the flowering and the fig trees and the beauty of that. Some commentators read in that kind of a counterpoint to the exile from the Garden of Eden that we read about in the beginning of Genesis, where the curse is laid out for the woman that her desire will be for her husband, but the husband will lord over her. That state of fractured, hierarchical, non-mutual relationships has a counter song sung to it and against it in this Song of Songs, where actually the female voice is way stronger than the male voice. So apart from it being heteronormative, which is a whole other conversation we should and can have, the fact that you have this strong female voice celebrating this mutual love makes it a precious gem in our scriptures and also a precious way of thinking and praying with and waiting for God. It's very different from the image of God and the expectation of how the divine looks at us and beholds us that the Pharisees give voice to in the Gospel of Mark. Their apprehension of the holiness, the otherness of God, has caused them and led to the creation of traditions that on the one hand help inscribe how one gets ready, the way I guess, really bad analogy, one would get ready for a date, to approach God. But it's become distorted. It's become, instead of a means to contemplation and entry into the presence of God, a way of deciding who is in and who is out, and of controlling and manipulating who gets in. And they look at Jesus' marvelously messy disciples eating with unwashed hands. I imagine they probably have food dripped on their shirts, too. And they're just sort of overcome with how appalling this all is. And they take Jesus aside and say, how can you let them do this? That image of God is an image that I think I, as a parent, all too often occupy when my daughter comes in a room. Or I catch the back of her head and I see the bird's nest of her hair that she went to school with. And instead of reflecting back delight and love in her presence, I want to comb her hair or lick the... Did your mother used to do that? Lick the napkin and like make sure your face is clean to go in, polish your shoes. But again, that isn't the face of God that we get in this marvelous text. This face of God longing for us, delighting in us, delighting in the incarnated carnal world into which God has forever entered. We're at the beginning of a new semester. We live in this community in perpetual transitional liminal space. New people come, people leave. In this community today, as Pastor Kathleen mentioned, after this the worship service, we're going to have a time of celebrating but also grieving the passing on of one of the longest-term members of this congregation. We live with bodies that are capable of delight and bodies that fail us? And how would our way of being together be fueled with powering love for our world, for each other, in this new semester, this new time, in the midst of all of the free-floating anxiety that such changes bring? So I want to send you all out of here with an invitation and a challenge to find ways this week and this year to pause and catch your breath and take in God's longing, desiring love for you. Amen.